Hi, welcome to Biggs on Film. I'm Biggs.
I'm Dennis. I'm Biggs' dad.
So we are doing the film The Day the Earth Stood Still. As always, you can follow along on video if you want. You don't have to, though. We'll try and talk in a way where we explain everything. Anyway, just to sync you up here, we got a 20th Century Fox logo here. I'm sure you can hear the sound. I worked out the audio a little better for this recording, so... Okay, so now we got a Sea of Stars, and we're beginning the podcast. So this movie came out in 1951. It's not to be confused with the 2008 Keanu Reeves movie, which is not as good. I'm just going to come out and say, I watched them both today, and I can say undoubtedly it's not as good.
Matter of fact, a gentleman who was doing a review of both of them said that if you've seen the original one, don't bother to watch the second one. And if you haven't watched either, just watch the first one.
Yeah. Now, I will say, because I did want to get kind of into this. So obviously the remake, it's somewhat faithful to this one, but it changes a lot of things. It changes one key important thing that I'll get into a little bit later. But it's not totally faithful. However, when you talk about faithfulness, you cannot beat how much this movie totally changed the short story it's based off of that I read today. It's called Farewell to the Master. And have you read this story, Dad?
Yes, I did read it.
Okay, so have you read it recently?
Yeah.
Wow, so you're totally prepped.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like the only thing that they keep in it is the description of the ship and how the platform kind of opens up. Gort the Robot somewhat. I mean, I think he has like four eyes in it. And they call him Newt.
Yeah, Newt. Like he's Norwegian.
Yeah, he's mostly Norwegian. Mostly.
Because he's very tall and slender.
Right. My alien fans will get that joke. Or aliens, sorry. But, yeah, so they keep that. But the whole thing of that short story, it's basically from the perspective of a photographer who's watching the robot. And he notices that it moves somewhat. And he basically follows around Newt. And eventually finds out that Newt is creating clones of things like gorillas and people from sound waves, and can't quite get them to work, but he like clones Klaatu, gets shot, much like in this film. That's another thing it has in common. That's about it, that it actually has in common. And the whole twist of the story is that the whole time he thinks that the robot's trying to bring his master back, and it turns out that the robot says, "No, you're mistaken, I am the master," and flies off. And so that was, I guess, like a head fuck at the time for like, whoa, robots are in charge of people kind of thing.
And he wrote that in 1940.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking, I don't think an atomic bomb had even, I don't think the public even knew about him yet.
No,
right?
I don't think there was any.
Like, I think Oppenheimer was working on it, but
there, I mean, there was, for people that were kind of plugged into science, you know, Einstein had been talking about the atomic bomb for quite some time, but it wasn't common knowledge how destructive they could be.
Right.
The other thing about that short story was because I did quite a bit of research, and Edmund North is the one that wrote the screenplay here, and he and Robert Wise, the director. Robert Wise was a wonderful, wonderful director, wonderful guy. A good liberal Hollywood guy that grew up in Indiana. but he also, I mean, he did some other really cool things. He did Sound of Music. He did West Side Story. He did The Sand Pebbles, which was actually the first Vietnam movie, anti-war movie. But anyway, Robert Wise had, somebody had given him this story. He said, this story is really interesting, so make a good movie. And he said, well, I like part of it.
Yeah, he basically said the only thing that he really liked from it was that the alien was friendly.
Yeah.
Is what I got from him in an interview.
Because he was anti-war. He was trying to, you know, there was a lot of fear out there about nuclear weapons.
Really quick, and then we'll get back on that. I just wanted to point out this ship. I was watching this, and I was kind of like, how did they do this? Because you don't really see special effects like that in modern day movies. Well, it turns out this is all animated, this UFO ship. They just animated it across. So if you watch it, this flagpole here, it, maybe it's a different one, but it passes in front of it because they animated it right over. They screwed up. But it looks kind of convincing, especially they like animate in a shadow while it's going onto these baseball fields here, which I think kind of lends to the realism of it a little bit. Like, it's kind of neat what they were able to do for, you know, the 50s. Like, that's a pretty neat little special effect.
And the ship was actually, Frank Lloyd Wright actually helped design the ship, believe it or not.
Now, who is Frank Lloyd Wright?
The architect, sure. Frank Lloyd Wright.
Okay.
That did Running Water, one of the preeminent American architects from mostly the early part of the century till the 50s.
Did he work out of the Guggenheim?
He designed the Guggenheim.
Oh, really?
He designed the Guggenheim
Museum.
That was
just a Seinfeld joke. He always...
Okay.
George's fake job is always architect, and he always says he designed the Guggenheim. That's his go-to, because he goes to that lie over and over again.
Yeah, it was Frank Lloyd Wright designed the Guggenheim Museum.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So now back to the
So Frank Lloyd Wright
script had... Script writer.
Yeah, so... Well, one second about the design of the ship, though, is that Frank Lloyd Wright had read about material that was being designed that could repair itself. It's like you could cut it and then it would repair itself. And he said, wouldn't that be cool if metal did that? And so that was the idea for the way that when you see it here shortly, when you see it open up.
Well, and when they get to that part, I can say I know how they did that, too. They basically... They had a seam in there, and then they covered it with putty so that it wouldn't be picked up from the camera. And then they opened the platform, and it pushes it open. But when they go to close it, they just reverse the film so that the putty seals it up, and you can't see the crack again. But yeah, they paid particularly close attention to that. They wanted it to look seamless.
Robert Wise, the director, was actually a very detail-oriented guy, and people loved working for him, but he was also very much about telling the story and making sure the audience was following what was going on. He was all about doing these for the audience.
And this is one of his first movies, too, so it wasn't his first, but it was one of his first as a director.
It was his first one with this studio.
Yeah, with Fox.
With Fox, yeah.
He also, he was a cinematography on a little film called Citizen Kane.
He and Orson Welles worked together. And actually, several people that worked on this movie also worked with him on Citizen Kane and some other things. There were, I was trying to get a count, there were... the people that worked on this movie, there were about eight of them that got Academy Awards at some point in their careers. None of them from this movie, but from other movies. Patricia Neal, Robert Wise had four of them.
Wow. And he was in some classics, too. Like, you talked about how the script writer was in or did The Sound of Music. Robert Wise also directed Sound of Music. He also did The Andromeda Strain and Star Trek the Motion Picture. I dug up. So
yeah,
your favorite Star Trek.
I actually, Wrath of Khan is my favorite.
Star Trek. Is it really? Now the truth comes out. Okay, all this time. Me too.
Well, this is really cool that they did this, though, because this was Frank Lloyd Wright's idea. Was it to be?
So we're
seamless.
Talking about the ship.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry. The ship. Since we got the ship out there. Because Wright said, well, if they're sufficiently advanced, they should be able to make metal do these things, or whatever it's made out of, whether it's metal.
And I will say that's in the short story, too. Like, I literally just finished reading the short story about 2 hours ago.
Oh, okay.
So, and that they talk about that it's seamless, and they couldn't find a way in, and they had chalk outlines for where they thought the openings of the ship could be, because they built a museum around the ship and Gort the robot. It's a very different story from the movie.
Newt the robot.
Yeah, sorry, Newt. Like, that's the weird thing
she
about...
She turned me into a Newt. Oh, that's different.
Well, it's interesting you say that because John Cleese is in the remake. Did you get far?
Yeah, he's the professor.
He's the one with the chalkboard, yeah.
Yeah, he's Barn, what's his name? But yeah, and interesting about, well, anyway, so the director, the screenwriter had worked with Robert Wise before and was really excited to do this project. And so there's a lot of, because later on, years after this movie was made, there were lots of questions and most of the people are still alive. There's still one person alive that was in the movie. That's Billy Gray, mm-hmm. who was in Father Knows Best. He's the little boy in this one. We haven't seen him yet, but Billy Gray had some interesting memories of this.
Okay, but, this is another thing that's consistent with the short story. So he comes out to give this gift here, and which, by the way, is a mistake, and I'll point this out. So you watch, this is in his hand, this thing that he's got. I don't remember what it does, but...
it's to communicate, it's to study other worlds.
Okay, now watch it. He opens it shoots out of his hand, and then he's got a shot in his shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, he's laying on his shoulder.
It ricocheted.
Is that what happened? Yeah.
Well, because I was noticing that too, and I had never really noticed it before, but when I watched it again to prepare for this, it's like, oh crap, that's fair.
I'll accept
but
that.
I'm guessing it's a ricochet because Robert Wise is really known for being very meticulous and also coming in under budget.
Yeah,
this movie was made for $950,000 and grossed about $1.8 million.
Yeah,
it did really well. It was number 52 that year.
They said it was also the only big budget movie to come out in the last 20 years when it premiered. Like the last one had been like 1930 or something like that, the last time there's a big...
And it was the first major studio science fiction movie. All the rest of them were, up to this point...
They were budget movies.
Yeah, they were B movies and, you know, weirdo things. And Robert Wise had also worked on another movie earlier with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, a movie called The Body Snatcher, which would be a fun one to
watch. Snatcher?
Yeah.
Just one, or The Body Snatcher?
No, not the pod people
alien one.
No, okay. This was...
There's so many versions of that movie, I would have totally believed they were in.
but Wise was, like I said, he was very much, he was also very, he was a very liberal person. And he was pretty progressive for his day, because he brought in other movies, he brought in people from other races, you know, to stand in the background. And I mean,
and that's one thing I noticed that kind of bothered me. I was watching, I mean, I knew it was going to happen because it's a 50s movie, but you're in Washington, D.C. There's a total of four black people in this movie, and they're in sets of two in the background. I guess they're prominently displayed, so that's something for the day, but it is this like whitewash thing that Hollywood did all the time. Like, just let's pretend like they're not there.
Yeah. Well, and with a lot of directors, they just wouldn't even have any black extras, you know. And
I give him credit for that. It sucks for the time that
there are other interesting
had to do.
Other interesting things in here, which we can talk about later. I don't want to spoil a movie, but
I'll do
right here. He's
spoil
saying,
no. Oh. If so, okay, let me just be clear on this.
Spoiler
if somebody's
alert.
Listening to this and watching the movie for the first time, you're doing it wrong. You need to watch the movie and then listen.
Yeah,
never ever listen to commentary while you're
and don't your read reviews of a movie beforehand, because some reviewers are douchebags and they tell you half of the story in there.
Although I will say, like, there's been a few movies that I went to because I was on the fence and I read a review and I was like, okay. Like, I will say there's been a few.
Okay, well,
I hear what you're saying.
I mean, I read reviews, but if they start telling too much of the story, then I quit reading them, because I'd rather be... I like... When I go to a movie, I want to be surprised a little bit.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same.
And kind of delighted by what's going on. And that's why it's like when we went and saw Mad Max and the new...
Oh,
Mad
my
Max
God.
Movie.
Fury, you know, Road is crazy.
Yeah. And it was, you know, and the first thing I thought of was like... So where are the people getting their food? Nobody's got any water. What are they eating? I mean, do they eat dirt? You know, but it's like, okay, we're along for the ride. And it was a fun movie. And it was supposedly this big feminist movie. But it's like, well, no, all the women still relied on Mad Max to save them.
No, they don't. This is for another time. But
okay.
I'm going to... Hopefully by the time that you hear this recording, because we're doing it a month or two in the past... By the time you hear this, we'll have fleshed this out on the air, because I do want to talk about that.
Okay, well, I'll skip that.
I've read the reasons, but that's okay. But back to this movie really quick.
So Rennie, though, it's interesting, because originally Klaatu, which is his name.
Right.
Klaatu
the,
was
the alien's
they
name.
They tried to get Claude Rains, who played Louis in Casablanca.
Well, and even right before him, Spencer Tracy as well.
Well, no, actually, you got it backwards. They started with Claude Rains. Okay, Claude Rains was busy doing a theater production in New York, so he couldn't get free. And so Spencer Tracy, we've got him under contract. We can use, and Daryl Zanuck, the producer, one of the producers.
He wanted a fresh face.
Yeah, well, Zanuck wanted Spencer Tracy, and he was all gung-ho. And Robert Wise is like, oh, yeah, we'll use him. And then he got to thinking about it, and he said, wait a minute. When he comes out of the ship, everybody's going to go, oh, it's Spencer Tracy. There's no surprise. There's no, he's a guy everybody knows. And he talked about it with Zanuck, and Zanuck said, that's really a good point. And Zanuck said, now that we're talking about it, I just signed this English actor named Michael Rennie.
He had seen him in a play in London, England, done a play before, or a movie before.
Yeah, and so he said, I'd like you to look, maybe you should look at this guy. And Wise said, this guy's perfect. So that's how Michael Rennie got picked for this movie.
Yeah. And talking about the remake, so one big misstep I think they made in the remake is in the original here, Klaatu, so you look at him and he's very charming and you get a good feeling about him. However, they do things when they want you to wonder about him. They light it just right, so he's so much in darkness, or you see behind him, like it adds a little ominous to him. But then when you see him talk, you're like, oh, like you're at ease, which I think is a really good thing they do with this movie. Now, Keanu Reeves, the way that they use him, it's just like almost indifferent. Like they make his Klaatu indifferent, which I think is kind of a mistake. And if I can just say this, so in that movie, they have John Hamm playing a scientist. Now, I know that at the time, Keanu Reeves is like the star, so you put him as Klaatu. But honestly, if you put Keanu Reeves as the dispassionate scientist, and then you have John Hamm, who can't help but being fucking charming, like I have a man crush on John Hamm. I'm just gonna call it out here. And like you put him in the role of Klaatu, I think already you're off to a way better start.
I agree.
Movie.
And they set him up differently because they made him, because he was grown, from human DNA. And
I thought it was kind of cool.
Well, and that's one of the things that I watched this other commentary about, remakes, and this, and the guy was talking about how I was so glad that this movie was sacred and had never been remade. And then they remade it and he said, oh my God, it was awful.
Yeah.
And then he talks about how the need to, when they remake a movie, to go in and explain all these things that they used to leave up to the viewer's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he thought that was cool too, the way that they grew him. He thought that was cool. But he also commented, said the same thing, that he was concerned.
Really?
Yeah, he said the same thing you did.
About Keanu Reeves, probably not John Hamm.
Well, no, I'm sorry, not about the man crush.
Right. No, I didn't think he said he had a man crush.
No.
He was so disinterested.
Yeah, because he wasn't emotional. He didn't have, he didn't feel love or hate or anything like that.
Yeah, he's just indifferent to everything until towards the end. And then I guess he sort of errs on love because of what he says. Yeah, it was a weird reading. Yeah. It really seemed like he was reading cue cards.
I was really excited to watch it because I thought, oh, there's so many cool things they could do with it. And it's like, once again, they kind of fell into the trap of doing special effects and not really making a good, tight story. The original one is a very tight story, I think. When you look at how corny some of it is, it was 60, almost 65 years ago.
I would say, though, because I'll be the first one to call it corniness, and I was ready to like jab you and make fun of you a little bit on this if this was really bad, but like it works. Like I think it still works today, honestly. Like if you can sit down and watch a movie from the 50s, this is one of the better ones for sure. Off the top of my head, I can't come up with too many from the 1950s that are better, because there was this super corny thing. They fell out of a lot of traps that movies from that time kind of fell in. Like, even the kid, he's not like, gee whiz, mister. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he has a little bit, but they tone it down to, like, what I would imagine a kid from that period actually acts like, rather than being an idealized kid from that time. Which seems to happen a lot in 50s movies. Like, if you have kids, they're like, well, kids are watching, so we got to make sure that they behave like the kid in this picture. Like, we can't give a bet. So they, like, they make them, like, golly, that'd be great, mister. You know what I mean?
Gee whiz. Let's go down to the malt shop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like that thing is, like, a little thing. But the kids got so much screen time in this. If you fuck that up, it makes it unwatchable from, like, the 80s on, for sure. I think by that point you're just like, ah, fuck this movie. Like,
yeah, well, you can, I mean, and this is a thing that especially rewatching it with a different intent, you know, the intent of watching it this time was so I could talk about the movie to somebody else, because usually I watch a movie and I try and talk to my wife and she's kind of like,
doesn't want to.
Don't bother me, you know. And yeah. So this time it was like, okay, I get to actually talk about one. This is one of my all-time favorite movies, actually.
I know it. Well, that's, and just to pull back the curtain, like, I let you pick a movie because I was like, I just want to do a classic, because we're talking, I think you're bringing up some newer movies that had just come out. And I was like, well, I want to focus more on, like, movies that have had some ground and some history behind them.
And we had talked about
this one. I'd never seen it before, so I said yes right away, because I was like, this, like, it's a different experience, because the last two I did were movies like I love that I've seen, you know, so many times. This one I'd never seen, so I'm just watching it the first time. I watched it through, like, new eyes, not even looking to grade it or anything, and then I've watched it since to kind of get more critical with it and pull it apart a little bit. But it's a really good movie.
It's very entertaining, and it really shows what a great director Wise was, because, you know, there are a lot of really cheesy science fiction movies in those days, in the day. Well, there still are. But I mean, you can tell that Wise's attention to detail, like, just stuff like this, like, yeah, and looking out the window. And
they actually did have a quick little thing I wanted to sure. mention there. He's talking about the UN genuine General Assembly, right? Like, this whole thing hinges on, like, he can't get the sides together at the assembly. You know, they just can't get all the countries in the room together. So it was pointed out, and I get it for the movie, but it should be pointed out. Let's see if I can find it here. But basically, any country that wants to go into the UN and listen and even have discussion on the floor has been able to do that since the very beginning. Unless they're recognized by another country, they're not allowed to speak or vote. But they definitely could have other countries in the room. And I would think an alien landing would let the countries get in the room. But I also understand that they're like, you got to, sometimes you have to ignore little things that the common person isn't going to know to make the movie work.
Right.
But that is one little crack in the movie.
Well, and I... much as I'm reluctant to talk about Ronald Reagan in a favorable light, this movie actually inspired him to reach out to other nations, because he said, if we ever do get that alien invasion, we're going to have to pull together. That's the only way we're ever going to, you know, save ourselves from them. But I think he said,
did he literally say that with alien
something
invasion?
Something like that.
Oh, man, if he'd only said that in today's day, people would just be making fun of him so much for that comment. In a world where the president can be, like, ruthlessly made fun of for talking about inflating your car tires to save gas mileage, you gotta imagine that's gonna get a lot of comedy out of it.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say, though, and so for you trivia buffs, another thing that Edmund North, that wrote this, also wrote the screenplay for Patton. That's the other major. He did a lot of screenplays.
Kind of crazy that, like, he was a peacenik, but he also made this, like...
Oh, no. Wise, the director, was the peacenik. Edmund North is the writer.
The writer was not also a peacenik. I thought you said
I don't know about the writer. Well. He might have been, but okay. I don't know.
I don't know a whole lot about the writer. I know a little bit, but...
Yeah, he did a lot of stuff. He also did Meteor, another... Not, that wasn't his fault, I don't think. If you've ever seen Meteor.
I have not. It must be pretty bad if it hasn't stood the test of time.
I think it was from the 80s or 90s, but anyway. But Rennie, I watched this, and the lighting.
It's so good.
Yeah, and this, and the entire, all of the, none of the actors left Hollywood. They shot all of that.
They
stuff
did everything in, Silver City, I think they called it.
And then they sent the whatever they call it, the second unit to DC,
do like DC and, streets yeah, and things,
a couple
like
of
that,
other but, things. And then they just did whatever that process is, where they paste people over when they're talking. And,
well, yeah. And so what they did for a lot of this stuff was they
this is cool here too for you, some
real newsmen.
But for you younger viewers, with the old cathode ray tube, which is what a television was, you couldn't film a television without getting
horizontal bars
across it. So they would actually do some process where they cut that out and they put another little film inside the film. It's some editing thing, but because you can't film a TV and see what's on there. So
that's why all those movies in like the 70s and 80s, it always looks kind of screwed up on the TV. I always just thought it was one of those things where they were trying to make it look like a TV and you're like, that's not what it looks like, but they... You know,
because
what I mean?
Can't film it.
It's the same as like they always have a live band at the prom, and it's like nobody who's been to a prom since like 1985 has had a live band.
I've got a couple of big, huge, old CRT monitors. I'll loan you one, and you can play with it. Plug it into your computer and try and film something sometime, and it'll have those bar. Even your monitor will have.
I appreciate the idea, but no, that's okay. It's like it'll take up a lot of space.
Well, I don't want to lift them up anyway. They're heavy.
Yeah, let's just let that get some cobwebs. You talk to Matt about that. He films stuff. I really don't film anything. I just record now.
Well, this was the other thing that was was very common in the day too, or that they didn't do a lot in science fiction
movies.
The
boarding house?
Well, no, bringing in the family, a family situation and kids and stuff. A lot of science fiction movies, there's not much. You were talking about it earlier about how the kid actually was portrayed more like a real kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of the movies, they just kind of glossed over that, and you know, but this actually had a real relationships between people.
It's kind of crazy. The other thing that really struck me when I was watching this is you have a mother who's not married and has a kid, and I think it's so the director suggested that she's a widow, but it's never addressed in the movie. Like I listened to it the second time, they never say
and there's Aunt B from Mayberry.
Yeah. Yeah, but can we talk about the how what a bad mother this lady is for just a second? Because we're about to hit the scene where she goes out with her boyfriend. And she's like, and Klaatu just volunteers to watch the kid. And she's like, oh, well, thank you. Like, thanks him and leaves it with it. Like, dude, you just met him yesterday.
But 60 years ago, you know, that never happened. Kids never got abducted or you know.
Yeah, they did.
I'm kidding.
They just didn't. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't big news stories back in those days.
It was a more naive time than today.
All right, you know what I like about that? You didn't say a better time or something like that. Like, you were actually more realistic about it.
Well, I'm 57, and when I was growing up, they used to always, in school, they would always give us this stuff, don't take candy from strangers, don't go with strangers, you know, all this stuff. And I didn't know what the heck that was about. I mean, it was like, why wouldn't I take, you know, and they would never tell us why you don't take candy from strangers. I got why you didn't get in the car with a stranger. You don't want to, you know, you don't
want to get kidnapped.
Well, yeah, I mean, but... they never really drew that connection very well for me, and it wasn't until years later that I realized, oh, the other stuff is happening. But
and they're pretty on Front Street now about the other stuff with kids, because you kind of have to be,
unfortunately. Yeah.
But it's not like the world has changed. That some things have changed.
Another interesting thing too, and there's a scene later that I'll try and remember to comment on this, but. Interesting that his character, his name is, he says his name is
Carpenter. Is this the Jesus thing?
Yeah, the Jesus thing.
Let's just get into it now. Okay. I got all kinds of stuff about the Jesus thing. So, and I have copious notes on this. So here's
copious.
Some of the,
wow.
Yes. here's some of the parallels between Klaatu and Jesus Christ, okay? Klaatu comes from another world and chooses the name Mr. Carpenter, which we just saw in his briefcase, which was the occupation of Christ. He came to warn about the destruction of Earth that it's going to face if they don't believe him and his words. Jesus Christ said to people that they will face destruction if they don't believe in him and his words. Like Jesus prophesizing about the destruction of Jerusalem, Klaatu prophesizes that the earth may face destruction, like leveling New York City or sinking the Rock of Gibraltar. Both Jesus and Klaatu die and later come back to life. Like Klaatu's flying saucer seen by people in the film, people in Jerusalem and Judea saw flying chariots and soldiers in the sky right before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. This was recorded by the Hebrew historian Josephus, Roman historian
Tacitus.
Eusebius document, Pseudo-Hegesippus. I just cut and pasted this. A Jewish historian. Documenter Sefer Yusupin. Also in line with the film's... Nope, I already read that. Okay, now...
Oh, there we go. Okay, there's her dad. There's the dad. Robert Benson, he's dead. He died in the war.
Oh, they did address it. Okay.
He died in the war. I didn't remember that part, but I just saw that.
Yeah, I remembered him saying something about going to Arlington Cemetery, but I forgot
So apparently, because this was...
And that's this whole thing that they're walking past, they literally just dropped a movie screen and projected like film of DC, which in black and white... Looks
great.
You cannot tell the difference, because when you watch that in a movie, like say in the 60s or 70s, it so stands out. It just stands out. Like when they're driving and you have that projector behind them.
And there's no windshield, so you can see right through everything.
Yeah, it's just like you can totally tell that it's all fake. But like with black and white, it really makes it work. I think it's because it sort of turns everything into shapes. Like, you don't notice definition quite as much with black and white. It's just more about the shapes of things.
Or you notice it more. Because, the people in the foreground are in focus, and then the background's slightly out of focus. But you can do that with cameras, too. But, I mean, just like if you're looking at... You know, when I'm looking at you, the back of the room is a little bit out of focus.
Yeah.
Because I'm focused on you. So it's more like your real... What you really see.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There's a great story too about this. Okay.
About the diamonds. Okay. So he's giving them that just to catch you up if you're not following on video.
There is a movie on, isn't there?
He gives the kids some diamonds, $2 for $2 so that they can go to a movie, which like I watched that and I was like, wow, movie was $2 like for two people.
Well, no, that's popcorn.
Oh, I mean soda. The diamond. Yeah. Yeah. That's
no, it's popcorn and soda.
All right. Okay.
With inflation, that's about what it costs today. But anyway, so Billy Gray, I saw a little interview with Billy Gray, and he talked about how those were real diamonds that they were using for this.
Really?
Yeah. And so the prop man, every time he used them, the prop man was right there getting them back from him. And then he said, I did manage to sneak a couple of them home. He said, I wish I still had them today.
Okay, I want to get back to the Jesus thing really quick, just so I can finish off. Okay, so there's word out, and this has been going around for a long time. Like, this is pre-internet. There's a story that originally Klaatu's death and resurrection at the end of the movie was meant to be permanent, reinforcing his godlike powers. But at the time, the Breen office, the film industry censors, didn't like the ending, suggesting it was too left-wing, and insisted that Robert Wise and writer Edmund J. North, or excuse me, H. North, put in
Edmund.
The line, that power is reserved for the Almighty Spirit, which did stick out to me when I was listening to it, but... both Wise and North hated the line and thought it was completely inappropriate, negating the concept of Klaatu's race being all-knowing and all-powerful, but the studio wouldn't back them up, and they were forced to put it in. Now, I gotta say, I've seen an interview with Robert Wise. It's not true. Like, not only was he not aware of the parallels to Jesus, which he does admit...
No, the writer was, though.
That's what I was going to say. Which he does admit, maybe the writer put that in, but there was never any discussion between him and the writer about it. However, that with the line was in the script. Like he categorically denied it, and this was in the 90s that he did, so he has no reason to lie about it,
right? And but North did
so
say
it's just a story somebody
North did
up.
Say they weren't going to use the line because he wanted to be more subtle, the reference, the Jesus
messianic metaphor.
Yeah. And
actually the Alien Movie Project, our friend Aaron Donaldson does it. They look at all kinds of weird things behind it. You would really like it, Dad. Like they just rip apart movies and talk about what it means in society at certain points. But they talk about the messianic trope with aliens all the time. They love that one.
Well, it's a really common theme.
Yeah.
And when you look at it, it's like this, I couldn't believe the amount of information there is out there about Klaatu, Gort, Klaatu Barada Nikto.
Yeah.
And it's the most, I guess, popular line spoken by an alien in ever in movies.
Well, more than E.T. Phone Home.
Well, keep in mind, this was 50 years before E.T. So it's been going on for a long time.
But yeah. Okay. So you know why I think, though? Like anybody who missed the boat for this film and knows the E.T. line probably might have seen Army of Darkness. Because I knew that line way before I saw this movie.
It's been repeated and repeated. There's a band named Klaatu, or there was a band named Klaatu back when I was in high school. It's a common thing. And interestingly enough, they said, well, where did, because he had to make up just a few words, because there's a few times when
he just made it, it's just off the top of his head.
Well, except that the Barada, he used to walk by a street, Baroda, Baroda Street. And so, and he said every time he walked to work at the studio, and so he just, I'll use that somehow. And so that's where the Barada came from. But I mean, I've read linguistic analysis of this.
Isn't it great?
It's hilarious. It's like people just have way too much free time, I guess.
And when you talk about the way too much free time, going back to this messianic trope, This is the last little bit I got on it. So I think, so obviously there's references in this movie, intended or not, by the script writer. They're definitely in here. Like you can see them. But it didn't help that when this movie first ran, it ran with a short called The Guest. Here's the plot of The Guest. Now, this would have been like a 15 to 30 minute thing that ran before this movie, okay? The Guest is about a shoemaker who has who's been a religious skeptic since the death of his wife and child, dreams that the Lord has spoken to him and will visit him the next day. He cleans his shop and prepares for the Lord's arrival and helps several people in distress. While the Lord does not appear, he is depressed with the thought that he has been forsaken, but his pastor points out that he was visited by the Lord through his good deeds to others during the day. So, like, you get in that headspace, you watch that movie, and then you see these subtle things, and they must have just stuck out like a sore thumb.
So here, I love this little scene too, where he goes in and, he's probably the only person that can figure out this problem, the celestial mechanics problem that's on the board. That's an actual physics problem that they wrote up there.
They brought in a guy from UCLA
this stuff, and so he's going through, and then he does some stuff and
circles and check marks.
He's an actor. Well, no, but he's saying this is wrong, in scientific notation. But this is the thing. He not only did he have all this power, he knew stuff. He knew how all these things work, and that's something they don't really say as much in the other movie. But like I said, I didn't have a lot of patience to keep watching it. But Klaatu was not as engaged in the remake, and he wasn't as powerful, I don't think, he had different powers. I take that back.
I still disagree with what you said, but here's the thing, because you have to keep watching, but he does the electricity thing to everything all the time, all throughout the movie, and he seems to be able to control Gort on a level that this guy can't. But pretends like he can't for a chunk of it. And he can also resurrect people himself, like Gort doesn't do it in the remake. So I'd say he actually has more power than
I got that backwards. That's why I said, oops.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I got that backwards. And it kind of undermines the premise that Gort is this really powerful robot.
If, yes.
You know, so it kind of...
Gort is just a bringer of destruction in the remake.
Yeah, and somebody else has to make the decisions, whereas this, Gort is pretty independent.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting thing about reading the linguistical analysis of what he said and all the different things. And I don't have that one here, but I can look it up while we're talking. But and actually, we haven't gotten there yet.
So. I think our Wi-Fi was a problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's working now, though.
Oh, okay.
But you look at the lighting, you look at the sets, you know, there's nothing really fancy. It looks, it's all places that people have seen, people that know. The director was very much about making things familiar.
Yeah.
Because he said, if you make it too weird, nobody can associate with it. Nobody can relate to it. And then you got the uptight boyfriend.
Yeah.
Who's a
insurance salesman. He's an insurance salesman, which I guess was a joke because like it was a joke with the writer because like he's her insurance policy. So he's an insurance, like it's a little inside joke. I thought that was kind of funny when I heard that. I was like, oh, OK, because I never would have come up with that on my own.
Well, I didn't get it. That's news to me. But it's interesting how his character is the one that actually gets him killed, that gets Klaatu killed.
Yeah.
And
he's the Judas.
Yeah. Yeah.
can I get on a sure. bicker that has nothing really to do with this movie? Sure. But I always like to talk about the like how whatever I'm looking at, like how it looks on the transfer, whatever. So we're watching an older DVD of The Day the Earth Stood Still. It's like a studio classics, it says at the top. So here's what pisses me off about this, because the transfer is clearly beautiful and they cleaned up things. They do on Netflix as well. It looks pretty good on Netflix. The difference is Netflix has it in the 4:3 ratio, which like an old school TV, which is what it was filmed in. So you watch this. This is right at the height of like, we want stuff letterboxed.
Yeah.
So
Panavision.
They just stretch it out. Like you go to an older person's house who doesn't bother to ever like get the right aspect ratio. So everybody's
they don't even know what that means.
Yeah. So everybody's head's just a little bit too stubby. And it really made me mad because I was trying to fix it before you came over. And I'm like, oh, this is on the DVD. Like I read the back and it said full screen, which I'm like, full screen is like 4:3.
Right.
And then it's an aspect ratio 1:33. I'm like, no, like they did it to us. We can't fix it. That makes me kind of mad.
Well, it was a inexpensive one. It's not
your fault.
Well, no, I'm gradually replacing some of these with better copies. But that was all that was available back
yeah.
then.
You couldn't get it. And the extras are great. I know that they actually did this. So this is a mark of like its age. Because it was made for Laserdisc in 96, and they just transferred it to DVD. You see that with the older movies a lot. But that's like the one thing, and I just bring it up because I am a guy like...
We got to listen. Okay, so this is a great, great little scene.
With the Albert Einstein ape there.
Yeah, so he's explaining the problem with the formula, okay? Now listen to what he has to say.
Oh, just tell us. It's too quiet on the recording. That's just there to guide a little bit.
Okay, well, the doctor says, well, you know, have you tested this theory? And Rennie says, well, here we go. It finds well enough to get me from one
planet to another. Right. Just gives away that he's an alien.
Yeah.
And you look at the look Klaatu is giving. Like, you know who John Hamm is, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Picture John Hamm in that role. Like, he was fucking born to play Klaatu. Yeah.
And I can't help but look at Sam Jaffe and think of Gunga Din, because that's who he played.
But I also like the thing I like about him. I know he's trying to ape Albert Einstein with the hair, but if you put a mustache on him, that looks like George's dad in Seinfeld.
Jerry Stiller.
Yeah, Jerry Stiller. Thank you. Usually it's off the top of my tongue. But.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, it's got funny stuff in it. It's got serious. It gets a little preachy at the end, but you know.
I think that the preachiness at the end is the best part, though, because of the way that it's delivered. I mean, so you know he's got this important thing all throughout, and they give you little hints, but they don't out and out say it. But because of the way that he's to deliver the message, it works. Because if you had that in a normal comedy, well, any movie, where you're like delivering a speech to people, it would come off as ham-handed. But because he wants to deliver it to everybody at once, and it is such a big message, I think that it works for this movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, I like it myself, but many people have told me they think it's too preachy.
I disagree with it. I think because of the method that they do it with, you can get away with the preachiness. And I think that's why it still survives. Because that preachiness turns people off if it's done wrong.
Right.
And maybe it's just people, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. I like it because it's very clear why he's there and very clear what people of Earth need to do if they want to survive, because he's saying we're going to annihilate you if you keep it up.
Yeah,
you're just going to not exist anymore because you're kind of a gnat and you're annoying us.
Well, not just a gnat. He's out and out saying you will be a danger to us and we're not going to tolerate it.
Yeah, and they're not going to wait till they even get close to it. They're just, we're just going to nip it in the bud.
Don't they say in this though? Because you're looking at it through where we really were in the 50s, but if you think about it, the way that they talk in this, like he's saying that you're developing spaceships right now, like you'll be able to take your nuclear threat outside of the Earth. That's why we have to stop it. Like, he's out and out saying you're becoming a danger, so we will stop you.
Yeah, we don't care what you do on your own planet. But once you get the capacity to leave your planet, then we're going to pay attention, and that's why.
See,
although
we weren't
actually in space yet, but it was a few more years
before
we were.
No, because it would be the 60s, right? Yeah.
Sputnik went up 6 months.
57?
Yeah, 6 months before I was born.
Okay.
And then shortly after that, then we launched ours. And, you know, we got in the space race. And
right. I was thinking like landing on the moon. I forgot
that
about
was
all 1969. The orbital stuff. And,
yeah.
And
oh, yeah. It's pretty impressive when you look at it that Kennedy in 1961 said we're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade.
Did it in 8 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But amazing that not more people got killed.
Yeah. Well, the Russians killed plenty.
We still don't know how many. I mean, because so much of it was,
well, some of it we'll probably never know, but they did uncover a lot of stuff where they've admitted, like they actually, I think it was a week or two before we landed on the moon, they fast tracked a program to send to the moon earlier, and they sent a crew and actually crashed a ship into the moon and killed everybody before the US got there. So,
wow, I haven't heard about that one.
But. Maybe I heard misinformation, but I thought I heard that on like a History Channel thing. And so
was
they
it that
actually
guy with
like,
the weird eyes that go, no, oh, this no. is evidence that the aliens have landed on
alien civilization. No. I hate that show so much. It's so funny that we'll watch stuff like this to talk about how great it is, and I'm like, no, fuck that show. Because I don't like it when they pretend like it's real. I don't know. I could take like the theorizing, but. No, but they actually like, crashed a ship into the moon is what I heard. Maybe I heard misinformation, but the History Channel ain't what it used to be. That's for sure.
Yeah, especially with Duck Dynasty and crap like that on there or whatever channel they're on. I don't know. But
I think that's A&E, which also ain't like it used to be. Can you think of a demographic that show hits that's more different than what A&E was for decades?
God. Oh, my God. Well, and then they're just such a bunch of phonies anyway. They started growing the beard to do the show because I saw a picture of them when their business was really booming, their duck calling business, and they're all wearing khakis and polo shirts and they're going to play golf. And they're all clean shaven. Every one of them's clean shaven.
Clean shaven like Klaatu. Look at that face, dude. Look at that baby face.
Well,
he can't see a whisker on him.
Only like 30, 35. I think he was.
They say, I don't know how old he really is, but they say in the movie.
I can look it up.
I think they say in the movie that he's, they think he's 33, but he's actually like 78 or something like that. It was something like that. I remember he's way older than they thought he should be. Because he's an alien and stuff. That's right. So apparently Patricia Neal thought this was going to be like a trashy movie and didn't give it a second thought.
Yeah. And she thought, she said, I kept giggling all through when I was trying to do my scene. She said, the Gort Klaatu Barada Nikto, she said, it took me many, many takes to say that without laughing out loud. Because she said, it was just so silly. She said, the whole movie was just so silly.
I don't know. It doesn't seem that silly to me, but maybe that's because I've watched many more fantastical things in this movie.
Well, it acting in a movie, you know, you're doing little bits and pieces of it.
Right. So you don't see the whole thing necessarily.
I've been in a couple of local productions, and I still have yet to see myself in anything.
I mean, in this day and age, can't you have somebody stand in the back with a tablet and just record it?
Oh, it was before the tablet age, so.
Tablet's been around for a little, but you've done some production since then, though.
Well, I mean, I've seen myself in shows, but a couple of shows where there were some, but I haven't seen myself in the movies I've been in.
Yeah, that's because they haven't necessarily been made.
Yeah.
That stuff happens.
Yeah, it happens, but anyway. But Patricia Neal, though, was a pretty interesting choice for this because she's very stylish and very formal speaking.
Well, and here we can pull it back to Helena again, too, because we're recording this in Helena, Montana, birthplace of Gary Cooper, who was married and stepping out on his wife with Patricia Neal while this was being filmed.
Right. And interesting. And apparently when that hit the papers, she was just assaulted by the press all the time. They always wanted she couldn't go anywhere without being bugged about seeing Gary Cooper. And so,
I mean, like at the time, probably the number one movie star close to it,
pretty much. John Wayne was up there. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the biggest by far, but she was talking about what a wonderful man Michael Rennie was, you know, and I'm expecting her to say she had a romance with him or something like that. And she said she was complaining one time about they didn't call it paparazzi back then, but talking about the media. And he said, well, every time they ask you a question, just look at him and say, Klaatu Barada Nikto. Yeah.
I was wondering if that's where you're going with that story. I wonder if there's any clips of her saying that to the media. Probably not.
Probably not.
But there's like this gray.
Well, she tells the story though. She's on. There's a YouTube deal where she talks about it.
Yeah. Oh, I just mean for footage back then. That's pretty tough. Like, there's all kinds of YouTube clips. I would say from stuff from like the 80s forward because people have VCRs. You have those tapes sitting around. Mm-hmm. Then I think some people watch them one day and they're like, "Hey, I can put this on the net," you know. But that stuff didn't exist in the 50s. There's no way to record that stuff.
No, it's just like, you know, they didn't do local
commercials
or very much or anything.
They did live spots on TV.
Howard Cosell was really the first person to really carry around a tape recorder because it weighed like 40 pounds and he'd strap it to his back. And he was one of the first people to actually record sports athletes. You know, right after the boxing match or right after the football game. Yeah. He was recording people back in the 50s when, you know, they had to go up to the radio booth or whatever to do interviews. And he would get them on the field with the stuff. So he was quite a innovator.
Now, I wanted to talk about the music for a second.
This is cool.
Now that we got a little sting here, but, so Bernard Herrmann did the soundtrack for this. He used two theremins to create the score. He had one pitch very high and one pitch low, which made this the first film to largely score it electronically. It was also the second film in history to feature the use of a theremin. Do you know what the first one was? It was Spellbound, an Alfred Hitchcock film from 1945 that had Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck. So the theremin was a big deal.
He did the music for Psycho. He did the music for several. He also did the music from this movie was also used in the TV series Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
They just straight up took the music.
And I forget what the other one was, another TV show like that. Lost in Space has music taken right out of this. which are shows I grew up with. I grew up watching right. those shows, and I'm sad to say that I watched a couple of episodes of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Sometimes you can't go back.
Yeah, it's kind of like when I tried to get you to watch Vanishing Point with me, and I think we made it halfway through it and just said, okay, this is bullshit.
I did watch it to the end, but I wasn't thrilled.
Yeah, I wasn't either. I was like, it was so much better when I was 18. I don't know what's wrong.
Sometimes I keep running into that with the kids too. I go to watch stuff from when I was a kid and I'm like, oh, like some of the stuff you're like, wow, this
that's
like
really
to
good.
The point of where I'm like surprised at what holds up because I've seen so much stuff that doesn't hold up anymore. Anything with Hanna-Barbera attached to it is just dog shit. I've been
The early stuff
yeah, some of the early bad. Stuff it's bad if you rewatch
oh,
it
oh I don't know but
we'll disagree to disagree okay, on that yeah. one
but most of them are just they're so stilted and also they were like 5 or 6 minute episodes
but here's my problem we might as well talk about it it's era appropriate kind of Hanna-Barbera has been doing it for a long time if you look at like the Max Fleischer shorts that he did for Superman they are incredible like the animation still looks great even if it's in black and white it just looks really good and you realize that they went from that to like being like, nope, we're going to go super low budget. And then Hanna-Barbera started making everything because they would keep the bottom line down. I guess like that's kind of the problem I have with Hanna-Barbera was I saw how incredible it was with like Max Fleischer stuff. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just look at a YouTube short of Max Fleischer Superman.
This is another thing that's really interesting. The guy that is in the Gort costume.
Yeah.
Max Locke or something like that. He was a waiter at Grauman's Chinese Theater, and he was 7 feet tall, but he only weighed like 175 pounds.
Lockmartin,
thank you. Something yeah. Locke. Anyway, and the suit was so hot, and his health was so frail that the director said, "Well, we're only going to do 30 minutes at a time with you in this suit because it was essentially this big heavy duty foam rubber." And to not have seams in it, they have a suit that they look at from the front, and then they have a suit that they look at from the back. So different scenes were different suits. So like that one right there, he's got a seam in the back, then you don't see it. But then when you see him walk away, he's got a different suit on. Yeah. And they also have the shoe lifts and stuff to make him 8 feet tall or closer to 8 feet tall. But
which, by the way, when you watch this squeezed out into widescreen, not as impressive how tall he is. Because he looks like a stumpy dude there. What do you do in 20th Century Fox in 1990s? Come on.
I remember the first time I saw a DVD, I thought, that is so cool. What do you mean 90 bucks?
Was that for the player?
No, oh, for the movie.
Oh, for the movie.
For just to buy the movie.
This it's a little off topic, but fuck it. We've been going off topic this whole thing. It's fine. There's only so much information about this movie, but I have this thing.
Frank Lloyd Wright had a lot to do with. He designed this whole inside set.
Oh, we did. Yeah. I kind of like the cagey look in the middle there. You got a big circular platform. It's kind of cagey, and then. Yeah, and then it's sort of lit up like The Godfather with
notice all the hand motions, no button, no push buttons.
Yeah. Yeah, that
which was that long ways ahead of their time. Nobody else did this.
He doesn't
touch anything. He just
Do you think that maybe they got the idea from watching them work the theremin from the score?
Don't know.
Because the theremins are used without hands either. A lot of people don't know that, but you use one hand for the pitch and one hand for the tone. And so you like move your hand in midair because it creates kind of a field.
Uh-huh.
So maybe they got the idea off of the theremins, considering that's like, this is one of the big, this wasn't the first to use theremin, but man, it's the one everybody thinks of when you talk about theremin.
Okay.
Who knows?
Yeah, but. I don't know. I don't know. But it certainly makes sense. You know, I mean, even in the Star Trek movies, they were pushing buttons all the time.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of button pushing. And even in like Next Generation and a lot of the spinoffs, they're like dragging their finger along thing. Like it progressed from a button, but they're still touching things to, you know what I mean?
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
Bobby, you've been dreaming again.
No, I haven't, Mom. Honest,
There's no, honest. Nobody ever believes kids.
Yeah. Cause, and whenever they say honest, you know they're lying.
It's honestly true. Okay, so that score I was talking about earlier, right. It should be noted it's also got pianos, harps, electric organs, percussion, amplified solo strings, and a brass section that includes four tubas. Just tickled by the tubas. Because I did an alien movie project a while ago, and I got to help do the Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And space tuba, man. That hey, ship is a space tuba.
The tuba was my instrument for a couple of years.
Was it really? Yeah,
because I was sick of being last or second to last chair trumpet.
And nobody but I played tuba.
But I could be first chair tuba. And I didn't have to practice because all the parts were the same, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Bernard Herrmann also inspired Danny Elfman to become
a diamond?
Composer. Yeah.
It's a beautiful diamond.
Yeah. That's one of the prop diamonds.
Yeah. They used real diamonds because they couldn't get prop because they wanted to show it up close but it was interesting. But, and this guy, now he's getting ready. He's got his 20 pieces of silver, so he's going to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's going to be in all the papers. Doesn't he say that at one point?
Yeah. So he can sell more insurance policies.
Yeah, so what I was going to say earlier, this was the composer who inspired Danny Elfman, who is in Oinga Boinga and is now, I would say, boy, I don't know. It's him or John Williams for the most popular composer at this point.
Danny Elfman even said this movie, seeing this movie.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying.
Yeah,
the music in this movie inspired him, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's another weird thing. So not only do you have Sam Raimi, who directed Army of Darkness. I'm just going to tie it back to the last episode. Not only did he, you know, drop the Klaatu Varada Nick 2 and, you know, people, that's a scene from the movie people remember.
Right.
Regardless of whether it's got anything to do with this movie, it's hilarious the way they set it up. But then his composer, Danny Elfman, one of the first movies that he was allowed to be a composer on was Army of Darkness. And that was his inspiration. So you're drawing all... That movie cannot exist without this movie.
This is kind of the Kevin Bacon of movies.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, it's pretty fascinating that when you look at all the people that touched this movie and how many other movies they worked on and other people they worked with. I mean, the more I dug through Wikipedia and then, you know, hit links, it's like, holy cripes. I mean, half of the people working on this movie had also worked on Citizen Kane.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, it's funny you say that too, because when I was watching this, I was just like, man, this looks like Citizen Kane. And so I wasn't surprised when I found out that the director was a choreographer on that, you know, but I didn't realize it ran that deep. That's really cool.
Well, and I think it's like anything. When you have relationships with people, you find it's like Christopher Guest with all of his movies. He tends to work with a core group
same
of actors.
People.
Yeah, same people. Because he knows what they can do and he likes what they do. And
Robert Rodriguez does that too. And Cheech Marin is in almost every film he's done. And people, like other actors, always ask him, you know, why is it that you don't get me in all this stuff like you do with Cheech? And he goes, because Cheech calls all the time. He's like... Cheech literally calls him up at random times and goes, so what you working on getting me in? And he's like, I guess you could be in this part. And then he'll like change the part for Cheech.
And here's the part where they, you know, if they'd had this scene today, you'd have to have a sex scene between
Stuck Claude in the elevator.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
See,
it's dark.
I'm going in a different direction. That is one direction you could say.
But one thing that they don't explain is where does the light come from? If all the electricity
that is like
they're in an elevator shaft.
That's just movies because you have to light it.
Well,
you
I know.
Can't have pure light. So it's like
I understand.
Always at nighttime, there's shadows being casted in places, even though it's nighttime. You know, but where I was gonna go was like if this was in a movie today, you would be having things exploding everywhere when he turns off the electricity.
And planes crashing but he actually talks about that there was a blurb about
he leaves the hospitals open, the planes like are able to land and then shut down. He did it without hurting a single person in this movie, which really
which is not what they did in the other movie.
No, No, not at all. People, you don't see people die that often, but it's implied that people die in that movie, you know. But this is more, you can tell that he was on the side of peace for this movie. Which, speaking of that, all the military equipment in this movie, they got it from the National Guard.
Of Virginia.
Right, because you have to submit a script to the Army or Navy or Air Force. Like, if you use them in a movie and you want to use their equipment, you have to submit a script for them to allow
to
use
approve
the equipment. Right. And so they look at it and they were like, nope. Like, something about atomic warfare being bad.
It was too leftist. It was too leftist and too liberal. And same problem that Stanley Kubrick ran into with Dr. Strangelove was that the Air Force let him do all these outside shots of the B-52s. And then we need to see your script. And they looked at the script and said, no, you can't be inside a B-52 and you can't shoot inside of our stuff. So the entire cockpit in the movie Dr. Strangelove, they just made up.
Yeah.
And then after the movie
was so accurate, they were upset because they thought
they were sure there was a security leak.
Story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've read it in more than one place.
Let's be honest. Is there any chance that Stanley Kubrick somehow got a photograph of it?
I know
he would deny it, but Kubrick is a maniac when it comes to details.
So he can't deny
it. He can't defend himself. Yeah. But I'm saying, like, he was a maniac when it comes to details. I wouldn't doubt he, like, paid somebody a lot of money just to, like,
there were plenty of ex-military people that had been on.
Yeah.
I mean,
were.
But I've heard a similar story about that happened with Star Trek, the TV show. They routinely had national security people stopping by and questioning them about where they got the information, like for Dr. McCoy's diagnostic board, you know, the thing that they would lay on the table, because they were actually working on that. It was top secret.
With the Moog synthesizer. Boom, 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 boom. That sound was always one of my favorite things. Which there's sounds in here that I've heard that I notice all over the place and stuff. Like, not recent stuff, but older stuff. The one that sticks out to me off the top of my head. So when Klaatu gets shot and you hear that, like, kind of, and Gort, or no, okay, I said that wrong. When Gort blasts stuff out of his visors and he makes those guns disappear, that is the noise of Spider-Man's webbing in the 65 cartoon. I knew that because I grew up with that.
In the 50s they started actually because prior to the 50s, when you know what a Foley artist is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look at who you're talking to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I've acted as a Foley artist on a play.
So listeners, if you don't know what a Foley artist is, when you watch a movie and you see someone walking across the snow, the Foley artist is the person in the studio making the crunch, 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 crunch.
The microphone knocking.
Yeah, the microphone's falling down noise. Yeah. But they do it. That's a manual process. But they also started making stock sounds. And then they would companies actually would have stock sounds like doors closing and stuff like that. And so that as they mechanized things more and more, they didn't have to have.
Oh, quick little thing here. They showed it earlier and we're already past the scene. But when you see the cop trying to start the motorcycle and won't stop, there's a stoplight that's still working.
I missed that.
I just thought I'd point that out. It happened a while ago, but we've been looking at each other and not the screen. So yeah. I was like, oh, I better bring that up. But anyway, so they make stock sounds that the Foley artists do, and you drop them into other movies. So, and if a studio owns that, then they can use it for free in all their movies.
Which is why I believe Lost in Space and Voyage Above the Sea could use music from here, because I think it's all 20th Century Fox. They 20th Century Fox owned everything, all of it, I believe.
Yeah, and I mean, they have such a library of sounds and stuff. And then, of course, there's the famous one that came from the 50s that you see in, like, every awesome movie, practically, or hear in every awesome movie. It was a man being eaten by an alligator originally. They found this sound. Nobody owns it, so they use it all the time. With some blasters thrown in there. But that is known as the Wilhelm scream. The Wilhelm scream is in Star Wars. It's in all the Indiana Jones movies. It's in fucking everything. It's in every Quentin Tarantino movie. It's all over the place. Like, once you hear that sound, you will not be able to not hear it. Wilhelm. I was shocked that it wasn't in this one. It probably wasn't recorded yet. But I think I heard that they recorded it in like 55. They think it was used in the first movie. It already existed, but nobody knew who recorded it. It just said, man eaten by alligator. And that was that scream.
See, this is another reason the military didn't like this was it portrayed them in kind of a negative light, because they were like, we're not going to even try and catch him, say, you know, keep him alive. We're going to, you know, kill him if you have to.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, okay, he shut the electricity down, but nobody got hurt. So why is everybody freaking out?
Because I think it's because it undermines government. I think it makes sense.
Oh, no, I'm just saying.
Like, if I was a government official, I wouldn't go after him. But, like, I think for the plot, it totally makes sense. Like, okay, this guy is able to seriously disrupt us, and now we have to, like, take him out of commission, because it's very clear that the alien's holding the cards, not the government.
Which is just funny. It's about
control.
It's really the definition of hubris, because, you know, we already know we can't do anything to Gort. We can't do anything to the spaceship. Okay, but we can kill this guy.
Although, to be fair, like, the only thing they've done to Gore or the spaceship is erect like a fence around it and built some lights.
Haven't they encased him in this stuff yet?
That's in the short story. I don't think they do.
No,
that
they do it here.
Do they? Somewhere. The glass X or whatever?
Yeah, that's something.
I think that's in the short story.
I'm pretty sure. Well, we'll see. Maybe we missed it already. No, we haven't missed it yet, because it's after Klaatu gets killed.
Okay, so maybe I just glossed over that.
So, spoiler alert.
Once again, dude, stop this if you haven't seen the movie.
And watch the movie first.
I think the only time somebody's ever watched a movie with the commentary on was when they didn't know what they were doing.
And contrary to what this movie shows, this actor really was a nice guy. He wasn't as much of a dick as his character was.
Oh, I mean, I'm not the kind of guy who believes every guy's a dick if their character's a dick, you know what I mean? Like, I've heard a lot of jokes.
Unless it's Sean Penn, right?
I don't think you're a Game of Thrones watcher, are you?
I haven't started on that yet.
Okay, but the thing of it is,
I did finally start in Breaking Bad, and it's killing me.
It's killing you, like, in a good way or bad way?
Bad way.
Bad way.
It's hard to watch.
Oh, dude, it gets better. Every season gets better, but we're not going to get into that right now. But, like, there's this villain, this kid named Joffrey. Like, I had never wanted to see an 11-year-old die before. This kid is such a great villain, but so many people are just like, I'd swing on him if I saw him in the streets. Like, no, dude, he's just an actor. Be happy he's able to, like, get that kind of responses out of you. But he's also a kid who is an orphan in Batman Begins, so you can't. You know, he's an actor. He could act either way. Just saying, you can't take it that seriously.
Yeah. See, and then he calls the general.
Yeah. By the way, this is a great thing in 50s tropes that I absolutely love, which is that people can just get on the phone and call the military.
Yeah.
Dude, they talk to the person in charge just picking up the phone all the time. There's no vetting. No, like, I wonder if this person's crazy. Like, nothing. They just get straight through. Get me Major Thompson. You know?
They're ground right on control the phone. To Major Tom.
Yeah.
I guess I had one more thing. I saw a meme the other day that was awesome. It was one of the astronauts walking on the moon, a photograph of that in the background. In the front, it says, the reason we haven't gone back to the moon is that there's nothing there to kill.
Well, we could blow it up, like Mr. Show. We're Earthlings. Let's blow up Earthlings.
Oh, geez. But yeah, then for some reason, all these trucks are just in line driving around, and we don't really know what they're doing. Okay, so they're looking. So
but they're looking awfully fast, aren't they? Clearly, they don't know how guerrilla warfare works.
And the guys in the jeeps, and then the guy with the machine gun on the top of the jeep. But there's
attention, all units. Attention, all units.
Now, how does he have a phone in the jeep?
It's a radio phone. It's radio. It's just a handset for the radio.
Okay.
So rather than. And they had those. They had those in World War II.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they had field phones. They'd crank, but they were wired.
I remember seeing the crank and stuff, but yeah. I always assumed that was like a radio kind of thing. But
there were wired ones, and then there were radio.
I guess it was the fact that it was old school two-piece, like one on the ear, one on the mouth. Seeing it with a handle connecting it, that just threw me all off. I was like, that's some advanced technology there.
And you notice that the taxi thing on the top isn't lit up.
Oh yeah, that's kind of hard to tell in black and white sometimes. But you're right, because it does, they glow just enough. The stuff glows to tell.
And then they park, they block the street, and they don't turn their flashers on, and it just annoys the hell out of me.
It's because they don't have to. They're in an army jeep with a machine gun mounted on.
Yeah, and martial law hasn't been declared, so they're really not allowed to do this. Because they're only allowed to do this kind of stuff if martial law has been declared.
Well, you know, here's the thing. The Virginia National Guard has whole different rules than we do.
I used to have a, I wish I could find this I had this cartoon I cut out of the paper years ago when all the militia stuff was going on, and it had all these trees in the forest, all these tall skinny trees in the forest, and you had all these bellies sticking out from behind these trees with camouflage on them, and it said, and it was the Missouri militia sneaks through the forest silent and unseen.
I love that the cab driver here with, you know, he's got one of those crazy newspaper guy hats.
Yeah.
That he's right out of the 20s. He's just like, huh, looks like there's some stuff going on over there, sir.
Yeah. They want him to look like Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
They probably couldn't get Mickey Rooney because he probably wanted more money than the whole cast got.
Yeah, and this movie was way under budget.
Well, that was one of the things.
Really low budget for the time. Like, the director, he got told that they were slashing budgets across the board and that he had to make sure to bring it in under budget. And he almost got fired because he got in an argument when a producer saw a daily. And it was just a scene where they're sitting at a kitchen table and it cuts to so many different angles. And so the guy was like, what are you doing? Like, we just told you to hold these budgets down and you've got all this film going on. And he like submitted the plan for all the shots and then showed how much film he used, which was almost none because he just planned it really well. The guy's like, oh, okay.
Because
like,
he was
just backs off, which wouldn't happen nowadays. They would have a grudge and they would probably start looking for a director anyway.
The difference for him being a director compared to anybody else in his time and probably today, he started out as a sound editor, then he was a film editor.
He like was at the nuts and bolts.
Right, and so he understood how this stuff all went together, and he understood the technology, understood the special effects and how to shoot everything, so he didn't have to set it up 17 times to get the right shot because he knew what he was trying to do.
Right.
So that's part of the reason he came in under budget in this movie, and it wasn't because they threatened him, it's because that's how he did his movies.
Yeah.
He did not overspend his budget.
Well, it was kind of the same with Robert Rodriguez, to bring it back with him. When he did Desperado, he was so used to editing his own stuff that he would film stuff and the studio looked at it and they're like, no, you're supposed to have like another 30 seconds there because they're supposed to have stuff for
and
choices.
Wouldn't you be nervous? Wouldn't you be nervous
how to edit it?
Wouldn't you be nervous with the military driving around with a 30 caliber machine gun like that?
Yeah, that might be part of the point. Show of force. You know, you could turn off the electricity.
Oh, now the cab light's on. The top light is on in the cab.
Oh, good.
It wasn't on in the neighborhood. Maybe he flipped it on because he was
looking for people now?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe I could get a fare out of one more person here.
There really aren't too many continuity things to this, though, when you look at...
No, there's a couple, but I feel like every film has a couple, you know.
I've watched a lot of those clips on YouTube where they show continuity problems and just like, how many times do you have to watch it to get that?
Yeah.
And then they shoot him as he's running away. So, I mean, and he's not even black.
Did you seriously just say that? Well, it was the 50s. It was a time when everybody got shot equally.
In the back?
No, there's so many black dudes who got shot before they could even get on screen. That's why there's only 4 people in Washington, D.C. of color. I just want to repeat that. Kind of insane.
And she just sneaks right out.
Yeah. I always love like the army guy who's in charge just standing up in the middle on top of something.
Stand back. You know? I'm under control. I'm in control.
Don't worry about this. I'll handle it.
Oh, yeah. See, they put him in the... block
okay,
of whatever
you're
it was.
I forgot about that. Now he's melting it. So I guess that's out of the short story.
I guess we weren't watching them. We were looking at each
other. But they literally make no reference to it, right? I mean, they just...
No, they talked about earlier they're going to encase him in this stuff to keep him from moving.
Okay.
There was something about... It was a safety thing. And then these guys... Yeah. Like a rifle is going to help you. An M1 Garand rifle.
Not only that, if you're going to go forward with the rifle and then you see that visor come up because you saw him like shoot out everything earlier.
And melt the tanks. And
why the fuck aren't you shooting it instead of just approaching it? Like if your big plan is to shoot it, just shoot it, man. Don't wait. That's all that I'm saying. But so I think those are the only two people the aliens kill in the entire movie. Because Gort knocks out two people later, but... I don't think...
Earlier he conked the guy's head together. Yeah.
You can assume. They don't actually show it, but I assume he knocked him out.
Well, this one, because he knows something's happening. He knows that Klaatu...
Well, this is where he's like going to destroy the Earth, right?
Yeah, and I have something here for that when we get to that part. Because we got to hear her little funny little accent. I don't know where she's from, but...
Yeah, I think I read she's English.
Really?
I think so. I could be off on that, but... you know, the strange thing here... Not the strange thing, but, like, they did this all the time. Like, Look, it happened in all movies at that time, but... Like, you have the woman is, like, walking up. I guess it happens in a lot of movies today. She walks up, and she knows all she's got to do is say the words. But she's frozen by fear and starts screaming. Like, instead of just saying the words.
I don't think she screams, though.
Oh, she totally screams.
Does she scream? Okay, I haven't watched it for a while. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she cowers in the corner and screams, because I'm just a girl.
And you notice the air vents under his chin?
Oh, I didn't notice that. Is that so that the actor wouldn't suffocate? There it is.
Yeah,
we even got
right.
The subtitle of two A's and an H exclamation point. By the way, if you're wondering, only the first A is in caps.
So it wasn't quite so loud.
But and this is ridiculous too. Like she screams, and now that she sees the visor, she's calm, cool, and collected, dude.
Well,
Rada. Nikto.
Okay, so. So a linguist, I took linguistics in college, and a linguist actually analyzed all the alien words used in this, and he said, let's see, what is that?
So was that three?
Was that he said literally, three words? Literally what that means is, stop barbarism, I have death and bind. And the translation that translated into English is I die, repair me, do not retaliate. Gort, I died, repair me, do not retaliate.
What do we know about this linguistics professor, though? Did they just show him the cutscene, or did they show him the whole movie? Because I'd say that'd be an easy conclusion if you saw the whole movie already.
Written by Tauna, T-A-U-N-A, Le Marbe, L... E-M-A-R-B-E, who is listed as their alien linguistics editor from Fantastic Films.
Oh, you mean he made it up as being that? Or
that's what he said it means. So apparently he analyzed all the words and said this is what they mean.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
That must be based off of the film then, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I was going to say
it wasn't like Klingon where people are making
right, where there's an actual language. That's like, hold on a second here. What would you even call the language that Klaatu talks in? Klaatese?
Okay. I don't know. So,
Klaatish.
So Patricia Neal was born in Packard, Kentucky.
Oh, well, I was way off.
So I don't know where that is.
There was a scene, by the way. They screwed up and showed a scene. I remember reading it, but I hadn't seen it since I read it. So you see him from the front, and then he walks out the door, and then you can kind of see a seam, like, where the leg fits. Yeah. But it's just one quick little thing. I do like the theremin, man. This song has, like...
Yes, sir?
it's been in my head since I watched this movie a week ago. Like, I just keep thinking about the main score of this movie. It just keeps the theremin. You know, an interesting thing, too, I can bring to this. I can't remember the guy's name, but the guy who invented the theremin, he wanted it to be a serious musical instrument. And, like, he had developed all these weapons for the military. And his one thing that he loved that he made was the theremin, because he wanted it to be a serious thing. And people couldn't quite figure out how to play it for the most part. But he was trying to get people to play it. And then this movie came out, and in his eyes, it was all over. Because then it became the shorthand for horror and science fiction movies was to have the theremin in there. And so he couldn't do, like, he never heard people doing serious musical parts with it, other than his wife, who was really into the theremin, I guess. So this movie sort of destroyed him. So it's not all sunshine and rainbows with this movie. It really hurt one guy who made a lot of weapons and killed people. He could have been Iron Man, but instead he's just another, I don't know, war industrialist who feels tortured. Is that fair to say? And he probably couldn't have been Iron Man. I'm just lying on that. Gort could have been Iron Man.
Yeah, but he doesn't have that snappy dialogue.
No, he does. He doesn't have any dialogue, in fact.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Let's see.
Although, to be fair, now that I'm looking at the suit, not that much different from the first Iron Man suit.
Well, I wonder if maybe Stan, what's his name?
Stan Lee.
Stan Lee was inspired by it.
Maybe, but he didn't do the... I said the wrong name for you. I'm sorry. Because Stan Lee wrote him originally, but it was Jack Kirby, I think, did the original illustration. So very well might have been. Jack Kirby was the shit, by the way. Oh. Just want to get
so
that
the theremin was patented in 1928, it says here.
Yeah.
God, I love Wikipedia. Isn't that awesome?
Oh, it's great. Kind of bullshit sometimes, but it's still kind of great.
Because you can like you can go in there and edit stuff and make it wrong if you want.
Well, kind of. They're not as... Like, they're so big now, it's harder to do it. You really have to have sources, but people can still do it. Something that made me kind of laugh was they have this thing where... This app where it's like fake Wikipedia. You can just type in whatever you want it to say about something, and then it creates a page that's a fake Wikipedia page that says Wiki at the top. So you could just show it to somebody if you're arguing about something. I totally got to get that app. I just keep forgetting.
But still, I believe it was the only science fiction movie of its time where the alien was peaceful.
Yeah.
And the alien wasn't threatening. I mean, well, he was threatening the Earth, but only because, you know, we were threatening them. They weren't going in here just randomly killing people like in Mars Attacks, for example.
Yeah, they said since War of the Worlds, especially, all of the movies that came out were just like awful aliens, you know, that just want to destroy everything. But this one is like kind of stood out. It was a very benign alien. And there's definitely been movies like that since, like E.T., for example, that we were just talking about, or Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but...
Starman.
Oh, yeah, Starman. My grandparents were sort of filmed in Starman.
Oh, yeah?
They were at the Grand Canyon when they filmed it, and they just saw all these cop cars and fire trucks, and they were like, what the hell is that? And it turned out that they were doing a long shot for the end part where he's in the Grand Canyon and the ship comes and picks him up. So they said, we're there, but I think they were just lying and pointing to a speck because there's cars everywhere around there.
Well, you may not remember when you were a kid and we were driving through Idaho and they were filming that volcano movie with Pierce Brosnan in it in Wallace, Idaho. And I can't remember the name of the movie now, but we saw the sets there, all the stuff laying in the streets and everything. Because interstate wasn't finished through there yet, so you had to actually drive through town.
So you're saying that I was in the vicinity of Pierce Brosnan?
Yeah. Well, the movie he was working on.
Oh,
is that another man crush thing?
I'm just gonna say Pierce Brosnan. That's a James Bond thing. That's kind of cool. Pierce Brosnan's not really. I don't really have a man crush on any of the Bonds. It's John Hamm all the way, baby.
I do have a great Jeff Bridges story that I'll tell you when we're off mic later because it's pretty funny. But I don't
is this
wanna...
about his wife?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not exactly. No, it's not really about his wife.
Okay. I was going to say, you just told me this story not that long ago.
Oh, did I ever tell you that? Okay, never mind.
Yeah, where he got kicked in.
No. But this is about his daughter, one of his daughters. I'll tell you later.
All right.
But anyway, so now they're all. Wait a minute, you're dead. Where's your helmet?
Yeah, Klaatu is back. Jerry Stiller's going to be yelling serenity now.
Now he's giving the speech.
If I speak bluntly. The universe grows smaller every day.
And you people are fucking annoying.
And the threat of aggression by any group, anywhere, can no longer be tolerated. There must be security for all, or no one is secure.
So here's the interesting thing about this, too.
Giving up any freedom.
Because it is... This is
there's a black guy.
Right, one of four. We've hit three now.
When they made laws to govern and hired police...
So... We're basically talking about mutually assured destruction here, right?
We have an organization.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, like if you launch missiles, you're going to be wiped off the map.
Kind of like the mouse that roared.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, so you have this leftist peacenik who's filming this, but they'd only gotten as far as mutually assured destruction. I mean, it's interesting. It's like the evolution of ideas, you know.
Except that it's not both parties being killed. It's just the offending party.
No, it is, but it's kind of a metaphor for that, right?
I mean, I would say, yeah.
Because if you like, it was very well known even at that time. If you launch missiles, they're coming back. Like,
well, yeah,
we're
that's a slightly different concept from this. You know, this is a. You're gonna have to give up some freedom, or you're gonna die. And the freedom to do whatever you want, no matter how stupid or destructive it is, you don't have that freedom anymore. And mutually assured destruction, because they could wipe out the Earth, and the Earth isn't gonna do squat to them. So it's not the same as mutually assured destruction.
What I mean by that, though, is that it is a metaphor for that on Earth, like. In terms of where we're at with Earth, if we launch missiles, we are going to die, which is mutually assured destruction.
It doesn't matter where we blow them up. If enough of them go off, the whole Earth is going to get eventually...
Right. And I realize that the aliens have no risk in this. Like, I get that. But what I'm saying is, like, it is a metaphor for that, right?
I think, I mean, I would agree with you, yeah.
Especially looking at this being in Cold
because he says,
War
join
times.
Us and live in peace, you know, then we can...
present course and face obliteration.
By the way, this is, and so once again, like, this speech, I think, was really good. I mean, especially that last line, the decision rests with you. I really like the way they do that. They just let everybody decide. But it makes sense because he's addressing people. Like, the corniness of that, I think, is diluted because, all right, I apologize, five black guys.
Well, one guy was twice.
One woman. Oh, really? So it was four. All right, I got the count right. Okay, but, oh, Baringa. was there anything from the linguist on what Baringa means?
I didn't read all of that stuff.
Yeah, fair enough.
I was too interested. I mean, we can do a follow-up show.
No, that's okay.
We can do a follow-up show.
On the commentary.
Well, no, just on general about, you know, different movies and different languages. We could...
We could,
nobody
next time
nobody
we do
would
one,
ever listen to it.
Next time we do one, you'll have to totally bring the linguist thing in.
I'll bring it.
But what I like about this, though, is
I like
that
it says on there that it's humming.
Yeah. Lets you know in case you can't hear it humming.
Thank God for closed caption.
Yeah. Well, closed captioning works at best when you have crowd shots of a lot of people talking. And they pick out dialogue you've never heard. You're like, some of it is so funny. But what I like about it is, like, unlike the remake, they tell you straight off what's going on.
You know what else is like, cool? No disruption of anything. No blasters, no fumes, no smoke, no...
Oh,
you know,
when they lift off.
When the ship just takes off and goes, and people are standing right next to it.
Yeah. But what I was going to say
technology.
Is, in the remake, so instead of having atomic war, it was about...
Excuse me. Okay. I love this movie.
we're going to talk for another minute here.
Okay.
But it was about the destruction of Earth, essentially, like through environmentalism, which I think could totally work as a message. The problem with it is that when they're sitting there looking at it, they don't actually like say specifically what's being done or like what you could do or anything like that. Like, it's just literally, yeah, you're destroying the Earth, so we're going to destroy you before you destroy yourself and the Earth. You know, it's kind of crazy. Like, you would think that they would think it out more for a big budget Hollywood movie. But that seems to be a problem with big budget Hollywood movies.
Well, you know, and they already have the DVD ready to be released before the movies even hit the theaters.
Yeah.
You know, and then they're selling whatever other stuff they've got, you know, action figures or whatever else. But it's so damned expensive to make a movie anymore. I mean, when you look at the credits, I mean, I always stay to the end of the movie and watch all the credits. Drives everybody else crazy. But I like, and everyone, and then all of a sudden you get surprised sometimes by even non-Marvel films.
I have become very savvy about that. I know exactly what movies you can watch stuff at the end. I just know it when I walk in, like what's going to have it and what won't.
But I also like to look through, just to look at the different names of people and what, and the jobs that they do. And, you know, because you have thousands of people in these movies doing stuff.
Kind of a bummer about these movies too. They don't tell you any of the crew. Like,
right.
Fortunately, we have IMDb back now. Yeah, I think that was a Guild demand.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah. What was I just talking about? I forgot. Oh, the movie, the credits. And so Terry asked me, my wife asked me one time, well, why do you read it so closely? And I said, well, if I ever need a pseudonym, I've got one. Dilwar Dutt.
There you go.
There's another one I like too, Manish Pingle.
All right, well, we're going to cut this off here. Thank you for joining us on Biggs on Film Again. Dad, thank you so much.
Hey, it was a blast. Thanks,
Alex. And I knew you'd be a natural for this because this is what we do with movies anyways. Half the time we don't even see the shit because we're just talking the whole time. Yeah,
not in the theater, but when we're watching it
no,
at home.
No, yeah, we theater, don't bother that's death. Yeah, occasionally a wisp or something, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
Not safe for network. So when you get the actual script in your hands, how is it that you memorize everything?
I mean, there's like, you write the first letter of each word.
That's what Robert Downey Jr. does.
Sure, yeah. And that's great for Robert Downey Jr. But
For Robert Downey Jr.
That just gets me so confused.
RDJ.
So RDJ. We won't be seeing you in an Iron Man suit anytime soon.
Well, not on stage. In my off time, maybe. But I don't know what you're doing in my bedroom, so please leave.
That's debatable.
I think the way we argue matters. The more diverse populations we have to argue with, the better. The internet, it gives you a lot of zealotry and a lot of that insane, you know, 9/11 was an inside job or the moon landing never happened or whatever. But, you know, if we could look at the flip side of that too, you get a whole bunch of information that gets to fly around the world in a heartbeat and all of a sudden everybody knows the same damn thing.
We had a good life.
Is talking about the Juggalo community on the podcast so publicly as we do,
yeah,
does that set us up as a target in the future potentially?
It's as much of a threat as a dirty 400-pound topless woman like running at you from a couple hundred yards away can be. You know what I mean?
This is family over here.
Family.
Box office battle.
If you were to take the male lead of your film and put him into a romantic comedy, would I root for him?
I have to say, we have seen this romantic comedy. Liv Tyler is his daughter, and he saves the human race in Armageddon.
Is that a romantic comedy, though?
You know, you had me until you said Armageddon.
Shooting the show.
My parents always stocked up on ramen. They didn't really know how much I ate. And I would actually scrounge up change and go to the store and buy more ramen so it didn't look like I ate as much.
Eric.
That's what alcoholics do. My mom should have never taught me how to make it.
Yeah, you had a problem.
The Alien Movie Project.
The aliens crash a kid's birthday party, basically.
Which, again, I think supports the frat aliens notion. Oh god, where am I? Oh guys, hey, is there anything to drink at this party? You guys,
I'm gonna have some of this cake.
Hey,
if I cut this cake?
Can I open this? Are you gonna wear that hat?
I'm just gonna take some of this cake.
Montucky Skies. By the way, his character trait is he constantly pulls out stomach acid pills. What do you call it? Like Pepto-Bismol or something? And he just constantly chews the pills every time something comes wrong. He's like, ah. Yeah. Just chewing the panko.
Can I just say, I appreciate...
Washes him down with a cup of coffee.
I appreciate the subtlety used by saying his character trait, because we know this is the type of movie where each character gets one trait.
Find all our podcasts on iTunes. Not safe for network.